My Word. A panel game devised by Tony Shrine and Edward J. Mason. Dennis Palm and Frank Muir challenge Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton in a game about words, with Jack Longland in the chair.
And we go straight into the first round, which tests their respective vocabularies. So for 2 marks, what's the meaning of these words? Dennis Norton begins. Dennis, yours is an ecdysiast.
I always thought it was ecdysiast.
It may well be.
Oh, it may be, yes. I don't know. I've never said it actually out loud, but it's a word much loved of a trade magazine called Variety. I believe it was coined by H.L. Mencken.
Yes.
And he used it to describe a striptease dancer, yes.
Absolutely.
And I think somewhere he said, as ye show, so shall we peep.
And let me correct myself, because I'm sure Dennis is right. It ought to be ecdysiast, looking at the words it's supposed to come from in Greek. It must be dysiast, not dysiast. I'm sorry. And in fact, it's a very scientific term in biology, meaning the act of casting off an integument, just as a snake does when it loses its skin once a year. And the striptease one does it twice nightly rather than once a year. Two more.
We used to stand at the back of the windmill shouting, cast off your integument.
Now, Dillis Powell's turn. Dillis, yours is a droop, and it's spelt D-R-U-P-E, droop.
Droop?
Mm-hmm.
Never heard of it.
It's a disease of chickens.
No, it's more to do with whatever branch of horticulture it is which produces orchards.
Horticulture? It's a disease of apples.
No, it isn't a disease at all.
Not a disease. It's a gift of apples.
Apples are about the only thing it isn't.
Squashy food.
Plum. Squashy, but what has it got in the middle?
Memon doesn't have a stone in the middle.
Pit.
Has a pit in the middle.
It has something to do with the inside. The hard inside.
One and a half.
You've been doing so terribly badly, I'm going to give you half a mark. It's a stone fruit. That is a fruit that has a stone in it, or a nut that has a kernel, like the plum, or the cherry, or,
is
if you prefer
it,
the olive. Did you say plum?
I said
then?
Plum.
Oh, well, put you up.
I said plum.
Put you up to 1 mark. It came in a list, including melons and oranges. 1 out of 2. Frank,
so the Boer's droop is a hard centre of a hop.
That's right. Yes, that'll do. Frank, yours is an embranglement.
It's what happened, presumably, when some original creator of words got tangled in a bramble.
Yes. Not a bad idea.
Well, it's an entanglement, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, that's right. Yep.
I was thought embranglement sounds like the translation of imbroglio.
It is. But among bell ringers, it has a special meaning. That is, the campanological imbroglio caused by one ringer ringing out of turn, in which case the whole blooming shoot goes totally wrong. But embranglement, as Frank is quite right in saying, it's a disastrous confusion or entanglement, and it's probably a mixture between brawl and wrangle, at least that's what the dictionaries think. Embranglement.
I used to be a bell ringer.
Did you often get
when I was young, in my teens. No, you can't. with change ringing, where the chief bell ringer calls the changers.
Yes.
You might get out of a step occasionally, but it doesn't mean tangled ropes and things like that.
No, but it does mean tangled tunes.
Well, they all sound a bit tangled.
Anyway, you've got to do marks.
The changing.
Anne Scott James, your word is a nuncheon, like luncheon, but with N instead of L.
No, I think it's when people say, I never touched lunch, I just have a salad. And they have a stuffed avocado pear with prawns, followed by roast pork, followed by banana souffle. And that's a sort of a nuncheon.
Yes, I think you're slightly overdoing it.
I am. Well, is it a light form of lunch?
I think that's right. It's a light refreshment. Can be taken between meals. Originally, it meant a noon drink, which is a very useful
thing. Do you know, Dillis always sustains herself before she comes here with a packet of digestive biscuits. Would that be a luncheon order? No, it's the wrong time of day.
It's the wrong time of day. It isn't liquid enough. And
there's also that.
Enters into it. We don't let her sit there munching dry biscuits.
No.
Digestive biscuits.
There's a bit in Browning's Piper. So, munch on, crunch on, take your nunch on, breakfast, supper, dinner, luncheon. So, it apparently was distinguished from the other meals, and was a light snack. Between meals.
Yes, it was.
Is that right?
Yes, no. I remember it. Yeah. It's 18th century.
Yes. Okay, two marks. Well, before we go on to the next round, here are the quotations you've been given for the last round of all, and Dennis, your quotation is, "He who hesitates is lost," and yours, Frank, is, "Dirty British coaster with a salt-caked smokestack." Second round is a round of origins and derivations, and for two marks, how did the following words or phrases originate, or from what did they come or derive? Dennis Norden, your phrase is, "to bat an eyelid."
Well, that's generally used in the negative sense, certainly, isn't it? He didn't bat an eyelid.
Yes.
He really is. I told him that, and he batted an eyelid. You know? It's fun, isn't it? It's only... I don't know. Is it...
Don't you think there's a very degenerate, not Mickey Mouse, but general cartoons where everybody has an eyes up and down? But
yeah. Well, it could be like a... If you do it sort of... It goes up and down silently, uh-huh. Like a bat's wing.
The wing is quite accurate, Dennis. Can you think of a time when the sports included birds that batted their wings?
Sports included birds that batted their
can
wings.
Can I think of hawks that would have anything to do with it? Hawking?
Yeah,
hawking, is it?
Oh.
Absolutely right. A little bit of help there, I think.
Oh, not much. Oh, now you put the ye Jesse over ye.
Oh, ye Ayers.
Over
yes, I know you do.
Over ye Hawkey's eyelids, yes. And it's so tight you can't bat them.
And ye get 1.5 marks.
Oh.
It's the falconer's vocabulary. Batting with a hawk meant it fluttered with its wings, either when it was doing it on the perch or when it was on your fist before you sort of loosed it into the air. So a batted eyelid is a fluttered eyelid, just like the hawk's wings, 1.5. Dillis Powell, the coccyx, COCCYX. I always mispronounce this, but it is called coccyx.
It means the end of something.
It doesn't. It means
the final bone.
It's a basal spine.
I see. Well, we never mention it in these surroundings.
Well, you're not lucky if you never get pain in yours. That's all I can say.
It's a little bony extremity.
It's a bit of the end of us all.
It's what you're sitting on.
Am I?
Yes.
Well, we never mention that. Really, all right.
Why is it called that?
Because it's my bottom.
That doesn't help my... The coccyx is anatomically the terminal triangular bone of your vertebral column, if you have one, as most of us have. But it's the Greek for cuckoo. Yes, coccyx. To early anatomists, this particular bone was called os coccygis because the shape of the bone was said to be like the bill of a cuckoo. Thank you. 19 to the dozen.
Well, it means to speak very rapidly.
Yes.
It's, in other words, it's somebody who crams 19 words in where most normal talkers could only manage 12.
I'm going to give you 2 marks. That isn't the explanation I got in front of me, and I've been trying to do a bit of looking up because I knew Frank would come back at me if I didn't. So I'm going to give him his marks, but I am told on scientific authority that it was the acceptable standard of efficiency for Watt's steam-powered pumps, which were used in Cornish tin mines in the 1770s, and the standard was that each pump should raise 19,000 gallons of water for every 12 bushels of coal.
Rubbish. Rubbish.
Rubbish.
Rubbish. By that argument, the phrase should be 19,000 to
That's
the dozen.
Exactly.
You don't know what's what.
You understand, Agent, why I got my bit in first. And now, Anne Scott James. to be in cahoots with, C-A-H-O-O-T-S, to be in cahoots with.
What it means you're very chummy with.
Yes.
Probably up to no good with somebody, I should think, too, going in for a bit of slush.
Yes, but origin.
Origin. Is it Indian word?
Red Indian, yeah.
Red Indian, I mean.
Well, French, what is now United States, but probably Louisiana or somewhere like that. Yes.
Oh, yes, I see. Mm-hmm. So do we have to think of the French language? I mean, en something or other,
yes,
or not?
Yes,
that will help.
It would help.
En.
Cahou.
Avec. Which is very well known. It's arm in arm with.
Well, it does mean that.
It's like we used to be. You've got the on, the abbot, right, abbot.
Yes, there are two plausible explanations here again, but they are more plausible than the last one.
Come on, let's think of a French word beginning with C, that's all we need.
Well, try C-A-H-U-T-E, which is a word which is not at all familiar to me. You might possibly know it.
No. My friend Jane Dutton.
Cahoot.
Oh, cahoot. Oh, I think it's a rather immoral word for a close sexual embrace.
you think all French words are immoral.
I give you 1.5 for getting jolly close. Two explanations. The first is it's the French word cohort, C-H-O-H-O-R-T-E, that is a company or partnership. But the perhaps more likely one is a French dialect word, cahut, which means a hut or cabin. So everything you've said, Anne, is probably true. But I can't give you more than 1.5 marks. Well, now you have a round of double definitions. And for 2 marks, what in one single word can be defined by both the following definitions. Dennis Norden, your two are deceptive humbug and the lower piece of a flitch of bacon. One word covering both.
Deceptive humbug. You mean that the abstract word? You don't mean a peppermint sort? No.
One is gammon. Gammon is right. Yeah. It's the ham of a hog, now usually with adjacent parts of the side, whatever that may mean, but housewives will understand. And deceptive humbug gammon is usually, I think, your accomplice in the 3-card trick of something of that sort, Dennis, where you keep on chattering while the...
No, gammon is what you say. It's gammon and...
Gammon and spinach.
You know, it's rubbish. Actually, ham would have done it.
Ham would have done it.
Wouldn't it? A kind of ham actor, deceptive humbug.
Yes, that's fine. Fair enough. 2 marks. Dennis Power, your two, leading to the same word, are on the one side a drop, splash, or spot, and on the other, a paroxysmal affliction of the big toe.
Root or gout?
Gout. They used to think that gout was caused by what Frank is very clever on, the humours in the 17th century. It dripped, drip by drip, down into your big toe and caused most terrible pains. So gout covers both. 2 marks. Frank, your one is an oarsman's bench, or to frustrate or obstruct.
Wet blanket.
You're thinking of dry bob or something.
Well, it could be the same.
Or a rower's bench, whatever you like to call it, a rower's bench, and to frustrate or obstruct, or to bulk.
To bulk, that's timber. Pine.
No, I don't think so.
Both can do.
Think of where you sit in a rather large boat and you are not strong enough and your oars are not long enough.
In the bar. Far. Bar is to obstruct or to, and bar is where you sit when you row, don't you?
Very
yes,
good.
One mark, next round.
I have done my turn.
If you sit on a bar when you're rowing, you're going to be extremely uncomfortable when you get up. No, what runs across a boat?
Thought.
Dennis, yes, go on.
A thought.
You've got it. You won't get more than 1.5, because I did give a fair amount of help. Thought, which is the crossways rower's bench that you sit on when you're rowing.
Yes,
and
yes.
To thwart is to frustrate or... Yes, that's why I said a rather big boat. You don't have it in a rowing eight. It's something rather more complicated. 1.5. Anne Scott James. A piece of ordnance, O-R-D-N-A-N-C, a piece of ordnance, and a collision of billiard balls.
A pot.
No.
A brake.
No.
Well, you've got, what else you've got?
Piece of
cannon. Cannon off the
cannon, that's Cush. Got it. Well done.
Cannon, it is. 2 marks.
I always thought it would be a lovely title for a cleric who roved like Eric Newby over the northwest frontier to name his autobiography A Cannon Off the Cush.
You'll have to write that one yourself, I think, then. Well, now we come to the last round and to Dennis and Frank's quotations and stories, and the marks will be awarded on the length of applause from the audience here in the theatre. And Dennis, your quotation is, "He who hesitates is lost," which is, I think, a proverb. Dennis?
Well, you may not believe this, but when I was about 16 and a half, if you'd have asked me what was my greatest ambition, I'd have said to have a big exclamation mark in my diary. And what made that fact all the more remarkable was that at the time, I didn't even know what that exclamation mark was supposed to signify. You see, all I knew was that one Monday morning, after the beginning of that term at school, a friend of mine called Snitch Corman came into the classroom, beckoned some of us over, looked round furtively, then opened his diary at the page for the preceding Saturday, and there, in red ink, was written 10:45 p.m., followed by a big red exclamation mark. Weedy Forbes said, "Call." We used to call him Weedy because he was so painfully skinny that he could climb into a turtleneck sweater from either end. And he said, "Course, Snitch, that makes you the first in the class, the first one in the whole class." And Snitch just sort of smirked. But I noticed that when he moved over to his desk, his walk had acquired a very definite swagger. The following Monday, it was Puffy Layton's turn. He came in, "I'm second," he said. He was shut, "I'm second in the class." And there, in his hobby's diary, prefaced by the words, 9:15 p.m., inside unlit telephone box, was another big triumphant exclamation mark. And then over the following week, one after the other of my classmates entered, brandishing their diaries and shouting, "I'm third, I'm fourth in the class, I'm fifth," and so until finally, and only because of the aid that was offered by some rather more specific detail in Wally Beckman's 15th place entry in his diary, did I then begin to realize that not only was there some kind of masculine status contest in progress, but that it involved girls. Moreover, unless I got going on acquiring an exclamation mark, Weedy Forbes and I would soon be dead heating for last place. Which is why I immediately rang up Bessie Arkwright. Now, let me tell you about Bessie. She and I had met under what would today be considered unusual circumstances. We'd been introduced. She was actually the cousin of the girl who ultimately became Snitch's exclamation mark. Although she wasn't much to look at, in fact, she was rather built on the foreign car principle, you know, most of the weight in the boot. Now, don't get me wrong, she was a very nice girl, interesting to talk to, and I respected her, but so far in our relationship, although there was definitely chemistry between us, there had been absolutely no suggestion of biology. However, as the school term now only had about 10 days to run, if I was going in for the exclamation mark, she was the only material that I had on hand to work with. So that Saturday night, straight after the film, which she didn't actually see because she had some trouble getting her glasses on over her false eyelashes, I took her to the local milk bar. I plied her with double strawberry shakes. Then I hurried her back to her home before my scented cashews wore off. Now, once in her front room, I said, Bessie, come and sit on my lap. She said, All right, then. And she dropped into my lap. Now, another thing that young fellows of that time believed was that girls judged you by the number of keys you had on your key ring. So, bearing that in mind, and also remembering that Bessie's shape was such that if she'd have been Miss Muffet, she would have required two Tuffets, I don't think I need go into any detailed description of what happens to a chap with a bunch of keys in his trouser pocket when a girl of Bessie's build drops into his lap. Suffice it to say that in the exclamation mark race, I was forced to retire hurt. In fact, three chaps from the junior school got to the finishing line before I did. That's why I still remember the words that Snitch wrote on his Get Well card. What it said was, "He who Bessie dates is last."
I thought it was the most ungallant story. As we pass on rapidly to Frank Muir, if you remember, his quotation was, "Dirty British coaster with a salt-caked smokestack," which is from John Masefield, a poem called Cargoes. Frank.
How did John Masefield write that line? I mean, what is the impulse? Where does the inspiration come? Does it come from inside the poet? Well, not necessarily. It can come from outside. It can be something that somebody says to a poet. There's a cadence or an arrangement of words or a rhythm which strikes home. Shakespeare, for instance. I mean, in the 16th century, Shakespeare was desperately trying to write a sonnet. And the main season had finished, and it was during the summer, and normally the Lord Chamberlain's company went on tour. And they did a kind of excerpts from various plays, and it was sort of compared by Di Evans, a Welsh actor who played the comedian's parts. And this day, the tour was just coming up, and Shakespeare was sitting there trying to think of a theme, of an opening line for his sonnet. And Will Kemp, the actor, came up to him and said, "William, what am I going to do when we go out, around the sticks? What's my function?" And Shakespeare says, "Do what?" Because he's busy. And Will Kemp said, "Shall I compare the tour, same as Die?" And immediately, you see, the inspiration comes. And the same thing happened with John Masefield. And through his wife, who was a constant source of inspiration for him, because he wanted a poem to finish his book of sea poems, and he couldn't even think of a title. And he had a little Austin 7, this was about sort of 1930, and they had to go down shopping, and he went and cranked the handle, and nothing happened. So he retired to his study to try and think of a title for his poems. His wife, meanwhile, went down, adjusted the advance and retard on the steering wheel of the Austin 7, gave one lift of the handle, and away she went. And she went upstairs, knocked on the door, and he said, "Now what?" And she said, skittishly, "Cargoes." he thought, what a marvellous title for a poem. But the actual key line of the poem, he just could not get. But in the town, they were at Broadstairs at the time, and they were filming in 1930 one of the first British musicals, and Gilly was playing the lead. And he'd been imported, and there was and starring with him was Lottie Lucas, who was a kind of ingenue girl of the period, a sort of gin and it girl, and she had to sing with Gilly, Gilly da 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 dee, da da da, and in this scene that they were shooting that morning, she wore a smock, she was a peasant, and she'd fallen in love with this Breton sailor played by Gilly. And gazing coquettishly over her shoulder, she caught her foot
in a rope and fell into the harbour. Well, there's no particular problem. She wouldn't drown. She was soaking wet. And they had a little sort of donkey engine and basket for hauling the fish up from the harbour. So they pushed her into that, and the donkey engine chuffed away. But, you know, a heavy peasant smock full of seawater is immensely heavy, much more than fish. And halfway up, the donkey engine jammed, and she was absolutely stuck. But a local photographer took a picture of this, and it appeared in the Morning Post. And the following morning, Mrs. John Masefield said to her husband, "Look at this. Oh, isn't this amusing?" And he said, "Oh, what is it?" She said, "It's a lovely photograph of this poor girl in the film." And he said, "Don't show me the photograph. What does it say?" And then she said it. She said, "It says, Dotty British co-star with a salt-caked smock stuck."
See how Frank could possibly get out of that one, but he did. And by your vote, ladies and gentlemen, he wins, Frank Muir wins the story, but on the other side, Dennis Norden and Anne Scott James win this week's contest.
Taking part in My Word were Anne Scott James, Dillis Powell, Dennis Norden, and Frank Muir. The chairman was Jack Lockhart. The questions were compiled by Peter Moore, and the program was produced by Tony Schreier.